Well, folks, welcome back to the Enemies List. I am your host, as always, Rick Wilson. I am delighted today. I did not do the Enemies List. It's the Lincoln Project. I'm so sorry. So
here, see? Sorry. Bad swing thought.
So many podcasts.
Your task will not be an easy one. Your enemy is well trained, well equipped, and battle hardened.
There is not a liberal America and a conservative America. There is the United States of America.
And good luck.
Hey, folks, it's Rick Wilson. Welcome back to the Lincoln Project Podcast. Something a little different today. It is summer. We all need a little bit of a reading break during the summer, a moment where you can ignore the craziness in the world for just a little while, focus on something. A great novel is always a good solution to this problem in my mind. We are joined today, and I'm absolutely honored to be joined by Daniel Silva today. He has a new novel out called A Death in Cornwall. It's the latest in his Gabriel Allon series, which if you haven't read it, it is amazing. Get to it. And I'm so grateful you could come on the show today, Daniel, and talk to us a little bit about both this book itself and the entire Gabriel Allon series, which has been a huge bestseller for you. It's been so popular. Talk to us a little bit about how you came to write this book and the arc of the story. Give us a rundown on a great summer read.
Summer escape, yes, but we don't escape the craziness altogether, because this book takes place against the backdrop of the British political scene of late.
Yes.
And as you know, as a political observer, the Conservative Party, the oldest political party in the West, in the world,
yep.
The most successful political party,
yep.
In the world. It's been the governing party for two-thirds of its existence since 2015 has been a clown show, basically. And this book was inspired in part in that period in the autumn of 2022, when we had three British prime ministers in the span of 7 weeks, basically. And that's sort of the broad inspiration for this book. But it is called A Death in Death in Cornwall. As you might imagine, it begins with a death in Cornwall. The victim is a professor of art history from the University of Oxford. Gabriel Allon is in the country when the murder happens. The British police ask for his help on the investigation, and one thing leads to another, and he finds himself in the middle of a raging British political scandal over the election of the next British prime minister. So it is a fast-paced, fun, exciting summer beach book. It's part art mystery, it's part caper novel, it's part political thriller, and it explores how you can use fine art, very expensive multi-million dollar paintings, for the purposes of money laundering.
Ask any number of Russians about that story.
Ask any number of Russians. What's the first thing they do when they get when they get rich? It is fungible. It is portable. It is extremely expensive. There are very few things in the world that cost more than a painting by Pollock or de Kooning. The price is subjective. Something like $70 or $80 billion a year worth of art trades hands each year. Almost all of it entirely in secret. The buyers don't know who the sellers are. The sellers don't know who the buyers are. Governments know next to nothing at all. And increasingly, those sales are taking place within free ports, and the money is changing hand in the offshore realm, shell company to shell company in a tax haven. So no tax revenue is changing hands, and it does not take a genius to see that this is the perfect environment to launder money. You can sell paintings to yourself. You can conduct sales of where there's actually no painting involved. No one would ever be the wiser. The story was inspired in part by some of the revelations that came out of the Panama Papers. That it's a little known facet of the Panama Papers, but the degree to which big dealers and big collectors own all of their stuff with through offshore companies, and you can't even actually identify unless you get a leak like the Panama Papers, for example, where you right. can where you can attach the name of the beneficial owner to the name of the shell company. I love this skullduggery of the art world. It's just so much fun to write about.
It is a fascinating sort of. Of undercurrent. You know, Scott Galloway referred one time recently to England Today as sort of a butler economy, where
that's a great term.
In the post-Brexit world particularly, they're a tourism and services economy, not the nation Britain once was.
Part of the butler economy is that London, and people don't really quite realize this, but London is the money laundering capital of the world now. It is the money laundering capital of the world. And I'm not saying this, okay? The British government has admitted as much, okay? The National Crime Agency it says that it's probably in the hundreds of billions of pounds a year. Mm-hmm. It's so large they really can't even estimate. It's not just a square mile. It's the smaller boutique firms. It's the law mm-hmm. firms. It's the accounting firms. It's everything.
Somebody said to me one time, Daniel, that if somebody nuked Canary Wharf, the entire Russian economy would go under sure. the next day, because that's where the vast majority of the oligarchs are managing. Of these wealthy oligarchs are managing their finances.
And successive British governments, welcomed this money. But you probably remember the famous Russia report in 2021. Mm-hmm. And it was a parliamentary report that said that Vladimir Putin and the Kremlin and Russian intelligence services deliberately used Russian money as a weapon mm-hmm. to undermine, corrode, and wreck the British financial sector and the British and the British political system. And look, there's a number of reasons why the Tories are out in historic fashion. But one of the reasons why is it's this stink of scandal that's been hanging over the party for a long, long time.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's fair to ask. I don't want to sound conspiratorial, but I think it's fair to ask whether the actions of the Russians and the kinds of things that they were doing played any role in the destruction. It's not quite the destruction, but the electoral annihilation that the Tories just suffered. They have really, really become a train wreck of a party. And then I don't know how much of the book you had a chance to read, but that is a theme that I explore. The second part of your thing, this global super rich, this secrecy world, as Jake Bernstein, the Pulitzer Prize winning journalist, calls this river, this torrent, this geyser of secret cash that's flowing around the world. I think it's probably a little higher right now, but the figure of wealth in private hands that I used in the end note of this book was $454 trillion in private wealth in the world. Probably 10% of that is offshore, hidden.
Right.
And you're talking about the global super rich. They don't feel like they belong to any country anymore. They certainly don't want to pay any taxes to any country.
Right.
And they are they we have created a global oligarchy that includes many autocrats, many mm-hmm. kleptocrats, and their various and sundry hangers-on and members of their immediate circle. And Ann Applebaum has a book out in a couple of
yes.
weeks, Autocracy Inc. I use the term
I'm
kleptopia.
I'm interviewing her, I think, in a week. Yeah.
Please give her my best.
To jump back into the story for a second, you've got Gabriel Allon,
sure.
who is a rich character you've developed now over. Is this the 24th novel in the series? So,
yep.
Tell us a little bit about Gabriel Allon as a character, and as a writer, I'm fascinated with characters that can run over a long arc. Tell us a little bit about the Gabriel Allon backstory and the role he plays in this story.
The funny thing about Gabriel Allon is he was only supposed to appear in one book and one book only. and I created such a good character that made that impossible. But he's born in Israel. To a family of German Jews. His grandfather was a German expressionist painter, a close friend and confidant of Beckmann and of that school of the German expressionists.
Sure.
He was murdered in the Holocaust. His mother is an extraordinary painter. So he comes by it in his genes. So Gabriel was supposed to be a painter. But he grew up speaking, his first language is German. He grew up, he's born in a German-speaking household. So he was recruited by Israeli intelligence. And he really lost the ability to paint satisfactory original work. And trained him to be an art restorer. He went and he learned how to speak Italian. He went and studied the craft of restoration. So for most of his career, he's living undercover in the West under an assumed identity and working as an art restorer. That was his cover job. Mm-hmm. And so now in the most recent books, I've flipped the script a little bit. So instead of Gabriel Allon is an intelligence officer who works, his cover job is an art restorer. Gabriel Allon is now an art restorer who used to be an intelligence officer.
Right.
And it's opened up a changed the tone of the books a lot.
And it gives him the entree in the storyline to get involved in the mysteries around this $100 million Picasso that's out there in the market suddenly.
Correct. So the murder that he's investigating, it involves a $100 million plus Picasso and its whereabouts. And without giving too much away, the painting is owned by a very dirty law firm that helps kleptocrats and criminals and the super rich hide their wealth and launder their wealth using art there's a sort of a nod to the Panama Papers and the Pandora Papers. Right. This book contains the Picasso Papers. Picasso Papers, a big leak of confidential attorney-client documents that unveils a lot of secrets.
Right. And how much time do you spend in England? Because it feels like your granularity there of understanding Cornwall. I mean, anytime you've got an English setting, you seem to have a really tight understanding of it.
Yeah, I love. I'm not quite an Anglophile, but I'm certainly close to one. I've studied British history, spent a lot of time in England. I've written about British politics before. Right. I'm addicted to British politics. Oh. I love the setting. I love English literature. I love English detective fiction. And there's so many reasons why I like using London and England as a setting for Gabriel. He lived in Cornwall. That's where he was living when I first introduced him. He was a bit of a recluse. I go back in real life as often as I can and fictionally as often as I can. I just love it. It's got a magic sparkle in the air there. This
it
Arthurian
really is.
Magic. And I just, I'm crazy for it.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned that, because this does feel like it falls into that great tradition of English detective fiction. And I was thinking about Campion and Peter Wimsey and all the sort of pre-Christie work that I read a lot of as a kid. And it does remind me of that and of the sort of the Lovejoy idea. The art restorer is a little bit bent around the edges, a little bit crooked. Are any of those, What part of Gabriel Allon's character sort of drawn out of that tradition?
He is, he's sort of a knight errant. You know, he can stumble into things. I can, I think the way I would answer that question is I'm trying, and I think I've sort of, he's definitely a blend of genres now, you know. Mm-hmm. I'm often described as a writer of espionage. Okay, I think it's more accurate to say that I'm a writer of international intrigue.
Sure.
And because, I am blending crime fiction, I am blending art mystery, you put a little bit of espionage in the story. So I think I'm sort of out there on a limb on my own genre right now.
I feel like some of the earlier books were more espionage-y.
Definitely. I mean, when I first created Gabriel, you know, it was a straight counterterrorism book set around the Palestinian peace process in Camp David back in 2000. But the next books I did were, I did a book about art looting and the Nazis, and then I did a book about the Vatican's conduct during the Holocaust and Pope Pius XII. So it really wasn't until I let Gabriel get drawn in, and it was a big decision on my part because I let him get drawn into the global war on terrorism, and that's when the series became much more overtly intelligence related.
And so
he did a lot of counterterrorism operations. And I'm also proud to say that I think that I was way ahead of the curve on Russia. Putinism and Russia and the threat that it posed, absolutely correct. And I was horrified to see an invasion of Ukraine. And frankly, I didn't dream that he would ever do something so reckless and awful, but not terribly surprised by it. And I'm afraid there's a preview of coming attractions. But the interesting thing is now a lot of my Republican readers think that Vladimir Putin's an okay guy now.
It is a remarkable thing to see that the party that I came up in, you know, I was in that last generation of young Cold Warriors at the Defense Department from 89 to 93 into the Cold War, the whole wrap up. It's remarkable to me to see people who now think that Vladimir Putin is somehow representative of Christian American values in some weird, perverse way when he is the least... He's the polar opposite of all those things. He's anathema to all those things. I just find it, that is an endless puzzle to me that doesn't seem organic. It never has seemed organic. Everybody from Donald Trump down in the Republican ecosystem now seems very willing to let Putin have his way. And I don't think they realize the depth to which Russian corruption is an endemic problem across the whole of Europe, not just England. It's an endemic problem everywhere in Europe. And anywhere that there's a marginally higher quality of life than there is in Russia and a marginally more secure quality of life than there is in Russia, they're going to go there and they're going to try to shove this money that came in the post-Cold War era that they all got through various chicanery and ill-gotten methods into a tiny sliver of the economy so they can live a lifestyle that is astoundingly far away from what most people in their home or their adopted countries could live.
Well, one of the things that I did when I was writing a book called Moscow Rules a few years ago is spend a lot of time with that sliver of Russians in France. I was in Courcheval in the ski season, Saint-Tropez in the summer. Oh, my goodness.
That is hard research, my friend.
To see the debauchery and the excess up close.
Oh yeah.
And well, it's
It's funny because, you look around Mayfair in London and there are hundreds of homes that are never lit, that are never used, that are never occupied, except maybe, a couple weeks a year. And there's a lot of these Russians on that circuit. They go to Miami, they go to Saint-Tropez, they go to Cannes, they go to, Monaco, they go back to, they go to Aspen, they go back to London, they go, wherever the beautiful thing is at that moment, they go there and then, and continue on. Right. It's a British friend of mine. He's like, they're like locusts. They eat up property. They eat up everything. And then it's not used again. It's sort of these hollow shells because a lot of them are doing it for investments. So this happens in Miami too. I mean, there are sure. these gigantic condo towers all in downtown Miami that are occasionally used when a Russian girlfriend has to have a baby in the U.S. And other than that, they're just parking money. They're just washing this ocean of dirty Russian money.
And I'm a Floridian as well. And I, you probably know this off the top of your head, but the percentage of all cash sales that we have in the state of Florida.
Oh, it's
in terms of real estate.
In Broward, there should be in Broward and Dade County. It's about 60% of all deals are closed, all cash.
I think 60% is it? I was going to say 60 to 70, and that is taking criminal money that's been earned through criminal conduct or corruption, and
right, especially using when it's owned by an LLC banking in the Cook Islands.
There you go. I'm for transparency.
Sure.
We need to get a lot more transparency into these that aspect of the financial world.
So I was thinking about something just now, Daniel. Do you look at this series as a kind of fictional window into the last couple decades? I mean,
absolutely.
Can you read? It just struck me because I have read a lot of the series, and it just struck me as like you could look at this as a sort of historical window as you develop each one of these. There is a window into the reality we're experiencing in each of these books.
Absolutely. It starts with a stand-in for Bill Clinton trying. Perhaps unwisely to go for a peace deal at Camp David at the end of his administration. It deals with the Swiss banking crisis that that was exploding at the time, and then it picks up with 9/11. It chronicles very, very accurately the rise of Putinism in Russia, the rise of fall of ISIS. Gabriel played an instrumental role in shutting down ISIS's overseas operations network. Iran nuclear program is dealt with. So it does, for better or worse, it has chronicled this insane 25 years that we've lived through to where we are where we are right now. I am overjoyed by the result of the election in France. By the way, I also predicted that. I foretold the rise of Christian nationalism, whether it's Christian nationalism here in America or in Western Europe, or I would define it as the link between doctrinaire Christianity and hard right authoritarian politics.
It's a weird marriage, but it's a marriage.
But it's as old as. Sure. The same thing happened in the 1930s.
100%.
If you want to get a slightly different perspective on the first part of this crazy millennium that we're living through, the Gabriel Lahn series does that.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. It just struck me. The other thing I was just thinking about while you were saying that, and folks, Daniel and I are just going to be book nerds for a few more minutes here. It also kind of reminded me, I just reread the Patrick O'Brien, Aubrey, the whole series. It also kind of reminded me of that, where Gabriel's got a crew. Gabriel's got people around him. So these other players that are in and out of your various novels, they've also become a sort of the fabric. He's not a lone wolf. He's not out there just, this isn't like a Quiller type figure. He is out there with a team of people who are all sort of allies, interested, you know, in and out of his whole career. And that it struck me that's sort of the Patrick O'Brien thing. You would see people come back three or four novels. You'd hear them in one and they'd come back in another, and they'd, you know, in and out of the storylines.
Yeah, the crew that he assembles in this one includes a guy who once tried to kill him. Mm-hmm. A woman who's probably the world's most famous violinist. They were lovers a long, long time ago. A professional assassin, professional thieves, two professional thieves. there's a lot of skullduggery and it's a little bit of a heist that takes place in this novel. And so, you know, one of the things that's great about Gabriel is that he's, you know, comfortable hanging out at a cocktail party on the museum circuit, but he's equally comfortable in the company of criminals. And I try to explain to people, you know, when you're an undercover intelligence operative, you are living as a criminal. I mean, Gabriel spent his life carrying false passports, carrying a gun, committing crimes in other countries. And so he's just very comfortable in the criminal element. And so I give my criminals a light touch. There's not a lot of nasty, awful violence in my books. And a lot of humor. So he assembles quite a oddball team for this novel. It's a lot of fun.
I love that. It is a fun novel, folks. The Daniel Silva, the entire Gabriel Alon series is well worth reading. But this tomorrow, the day we're recording this, on the 9th of July, the new one, A Death in Cornwall, is available everywhere fine books are sold. Daniel Silva, I want to thank you so much for coming on the Lincoln Project podcast. And folks, I hope you enjoyed us taking a day where you can have a little bit of summer, a little bit of a distraction from the chaos around us, because it's all coming back in on the next episode. Thanks again. Hey, everybody. Hope you enjoyed this podcast episode with Daniel Silva. I would also like to ask you all for a big personal favor. If you could go ahead on your favorite podcast app and subscribe to the Lincoln Project podcast, that would be awesome. The algorithm demands that we feed it. And your liking, subscribing, and sharing our content helps grow the podcast and helps support the Lincoln Project in a real way. And we look forward to talking to you again next time. Once again, like and subscribe. Thanks, everybody.
Good luck.